Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Filmography is back, and just in time for Halloween season, we're taking a deep dive into the master of horror, John Carpenter. Starting September 27th, host Dominic Suzanne Mayer and a rotating panel of guests will break down each of Carpenter's 20 feature-length movies to date, with new episodes every Thursday. Grab your synthesizer, your flares, and your best Shatner mask, and come along on this latest journey with us.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello to all of you sweet, sweet pod people out there. Welcome to this week's episode of This Must Be The Gig. I am your host, Leo Phillips, and this is your little backstage pass to the world of live music. You asked for it. You asked for every week us bringing a fascinating conversation from the depths, the depths of the live music and performance arenas. And that could also mean a musician that I chat to. It could mean I scout a festival founder, a choreographer that I love, a comedian, an actor, really anyone obsessed with live music the way we are. And before we dig into this week's lovely interview, let's check in with our constant companion, our CC, our engineer, our co-host here at TMBTG Studios, Adam.
Co-host with the co-most.
I nearly dived over that high-pitched of my own. I went at a home.
I went at a home.
I can't do it. I don't have quite the range you do.
This is great. Oh, yeah. I have range, all right. Free range, as in the eggs in my fridge. So, what up?
Can you believe that this is episode 34?
Oh my God, are we already at number 34? That is amazing. Do you know, I'm just about to Google, who was born in 1934? Trivia time!
I'm going to guess.
Guess. Oh wait, ooh. That may be mean.
I'm going to say, I'm going to say Raul Julia.
Great.
Is that accurate?
Otherwise known as Raul Julia. Who is that?
That was the dad in the Addams Family movies in the 90s. And also, I believe he was the villain in Street Fighter, if I'm not mistaken.
Listen, this is not over only trivia hour. This is trivia life.
Yeah.
We're on your TLs, and I'm not talking about your timeline.
Hey.
So Sophia Loren was born in 1934.
Ooh.
Hold on, I'm scrolling. Dame Judy Dench. How dare I?
Wait a second. Judy Dench and Sophia Loren were born in the same year?
Oh, yeah. Judy Dench.
That's insane.
Also, we don't call her just Judy.
I'm sorry.
She ain't no Judge Judy. She is a dame.
I'm sorry. My apologies to the dame family.
Guess who else?
Who else?
Maggie Smith. I love this game.
This
it
is
was
a fun...
an on-the-spot trivia
we need to,
life
we need to just start doing this
TL
every
game.
Week.
Carl Sagan.
Okay, star stuff. I get
Frankie
it.
Frankie Valli.
I wish I could do the high-pitched voice to keep it going, but I
Shirley
can't.
Shirley MacLaine. Bridget Bardot. Yuri Gagarin. A cosmonaut. Do you remember that guy from history class?
I had a friend in college who started a band called the Cosmonauts.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Yuri Gagarin. That would be great. my friend
in high school was Yuri Gagarin.
Yeah.
I looked up Raul Julia. He was born in 1940. I was close.
I mean, come on.
I was close.
You were close. 7 years.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. We'll name a few more because this is really... Oh, R.I.P. Alan Arkin.
Did Alan Arkin die? I don't think he died.
No, wait. This is no laughing matter. Celebs and icons die all the time.
Alan Arkin is still alive.
Okay. Alan, if you are not listening, there's no way Alan Arkin listens to this podcast.
I dare you to listen to this, Alan Arkin.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
Or
while
Adam Arkin.
Here, Alan Arkin, come on the show so that you can prove you're not dead.
Adam Arkin, you can also...
I never want him to die.
Adam Arkin can listen and come on the show as well.
Who's that?
You would know him if you saw him. He's one of those guys. Oh, he was on Chicago Hope.
We have not only said that Alan Arkin is dead, we have also said somebody else is one of those guys.
He was on Chicago Hope. He was on Sons of Anarchy for a while. Here's Adam Arkin.
Oh, that guy. He's lovely. Google Adam Arkin. It's one of those guys. He's really sweet. So 1934 was a pretty special year. Let's just say that. You got some Maggies. You got some Judys. You got some Sophias.
Sophia.
You got some Allens. Oh, Leonard Cohen.
Hey.
We love Leonard. Anyway, back to real news.
Back to our number 34. Our news.
Wait, do you know what's even better than 1934?
What is better than 1934?
This week's guest.
Hey.
Kimbra, I'm so excited. I've been wanting to chat to her ever since this podcast started. Actually, for much longer than that, for a few years. Kimbra is one of the most exciting and unique voices in pop music. She's just someone, I think, who blends bits of so many genres into the most beguiling songs. And you might know the famous New Zealand star from the absolutely inescapable Gotye song on the radio all the time in 2012.
Sounds right.
Somebody that I used to know. Yes, you can sing that. You have my blessings. And also her own stunners like Warrior and Settle Down and so many. Also from this year's unstoppably heartfelt and honest album Primal Heart.
It's very rare that a pop artist would reference Michael Jackson and Guided by Voices, Stevie Wonder and Faith No More as influences, but that's just who Kimbra is. She is not your usual pop artist. And in this interview, you got to chat about some of those first inspirations, including Silverchair.
I know!
Who she saw as a teen, and then later went on to work with frontman Daniel Johns on 2014's The Golden Echo.
It's super cool. And we also got to chat about getting to work with all-time podcast favorite and podcast namee. That's what he is, hey?
Absolutely.
That's what he is. But he's much more than that. Ugh. David Byrne.
Hero, god, legend.
And what it's like to assert your own creative voice into the music industry despite constantly feeling under obligation to others as a woman, as an artist, and the art of moving across the world, which she has done, and how Nine Inch Nails inspired her electronic streak.
There's a lot of really impressive, beautiful, nuanced conversation about feminism and finding your own strength. I was just really impressed and empowered as a person listening to it, and I can only imagine how it must feel for others who have had to face those same struggles. It's just a very beautiful conversation.
It was really wonderful. And the way that she also is able to articulate how she feels about certain issues and challenges within the industry and the really positive, wonderful things too. She's just got a great outlook. And she's also a Grammy Award winner.
And hey, once you've heard the entire conversation this week, leave us a note about it on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at TMBTGpod. TMBTGpod. Or, better yet, leave that thought as a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Doesn't have to be Apple, but that's just, you know, something common, I guess.
Spotify.
Google. I don't think you can... Can you rate on Spotify? I don't know. Google. Stitcher.
Stitchers.
If you leave us a 5-star review, you could get a shout out on the show.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. You know who just wrote a lovely review and gets their own special shout out?
Oh my gosh, we saw that one today.
Hard Rocker 5150.
Amazing. Good job.
Didn't leave a specific name to call you, but that's okay.
We like it. Maybe they are also born in 1934.
It's entirely possible. Or they were born in 5150.
Right. Maybe it is the alien from the future listening to local earthly podcasts, and they chose ours.
Well, nice job, Hard Rocker 5150, wherever you are. You're a cool person, or alien, that we love very much.
Very much.
If you want to be like Hard Rocker 5150 and help us out and be really cool.
Oh, it was so sweet. It's such a good review.
Take the 2 minutes, maybe maximum, that it would take and write a gosh darn review, and you'll hear your name on the podcast next week.
Do it. Let us not be distracted from this week's wonderful chat. Let's get right into it. This is me and Kimbra. Enjoy!
I've just been on tour in Australia and New Zealand. I'm actually in Fiji right now.
Oh my gosh. Are you on a little holiday, or are you doing something there work-wise?
No, just a stopover before we head to Los Angeles for the start of our tour out there.
How long have you lived in the States for?
Let's see. I have been there for about 5 years now, over 5 years, yeah. So it's definitely been an amazing journey. I mean, I lived in LA first and then moved to New York about 2 years ago, or 3 years ago now. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I'm really enjoying it. I think I really found my home in New York, and I see myself there for a while.
That's so interesting, because obviously your culture is so different to American culture.
Oh, yeah.
And because I know for me, I'm South African, so I suppose we always find some sort of connection with the Southern Hemisphere folk. And and obviously, as you said, you recorded in LA a few years ago, and now you recorded your latest album, Primal Heart, primarily in New York. And although, obviously, I know a place can definitely inform the way that you approach your own art, how do you feel moving around can really affect the way that you interact with your internal self?
Well, I think you said it perfectly, where, you know, there's the external experience of being in a new culture and adapting to new ways of interacting and understanding people. And then there's also the internal experience of kind of feeling at home in a new place, and kind of the things that it raises within your own awareness and kind of sense of self. And I think New York is a city that is very, I think, confrontational in the way that it approaches
very,
you. You know, you kind of have to, you really have to sort of spend a lot of time knowing what you want and communicating really clearly with people, and also being, you know, face to face with not only wonderful, you know, highs and kind of glamour and excitement and incredible architecture, but also the real woes of the human condition, you know, homelessness and poverty, and kind of experiencing all of that just on a trip on the subway. So I think in that sense, it makes you, as you said, you know, really question yourself in an internal way and decide what you believe and what you stand for as a human being. I think that's really important, especially for an artist, you know, to not become too complacent, but to be always in a place where you're questioning your ideas, your constructs of thinking, and externally being inspired, but also internally being challenged.
I know, I always feel, especially with creativity, putting yourself in a situation that's a little bit uncomfortable feels horrendous. And sometimes that feels like it's the only way you can potentially stretch and move around within whatever ideals you've had in the past or whatever you're trying to create.
Yeah.
But it can obviously get difficult to be moving around and not having your creature comforts, you know. Normal people would be like, oh, well, I want to be in my studio. I want to be with my friends and my family. So I think it's quite amazing that you did that and you created such incredible work by also not being close to those comforts.
Well, I mean, I left the home at 17 and it's become like a way of life to keep setting up a new community wherever I go. I will say that in New York, I did really, you know, indulge in some creature comforts by having my own apartment, having my own studio inside my apartment. So I did really write a lot of the record in that home studio. And yeah, I really took time to be cooking and spending time with friends and, you know, doing things that perhaps are a little more normal. And I think that is important. I'm certainly not the person that has to be traveling at every second that definitely can drive anyone crazy.
Wait, so you started when you were 17?
I mean, I started music far before that, but I left New Zealand at 17 to live in Australia for 5 years.
Oh my
gosh, yeah, it's
that's kind so of young.
A lot of, yeah, moving.
So what made you decide to start singing in the first place? Was it a show that you saw, or was it something, are your family in music? What was the impetus to your passion?
Well, my parents are actually doctor and nurse, so there wasn't a lot of, you know, music necessarily around all the time, but I was very drawn to it from as early as I can remember. I did love a lot of theatre and shows and also a lot of music on the radio, and then I picked up guitar at 12. And
oh my
I was
gosh.
Already writing little songs before that. No, I mean, I remember writing the silly little songs from about 8 or 9, and they even have them recorded on tape, and they're just, you know, they're fun. But it was clear that it was a sort of language for me, you know, to express myself. And then after learning guitar, I think I became a lot more inspired by the kind of singer-songwriters, whether that was Stevie Wonder or Joni Mitchell, or, you know, people that were writing on an instrument. And that's what inspired me to kind of start taking it more seriously. And at 17, I was signed to a management company. And, you know, signed to start making my first album, Vowels. So that's how I moved away from home, was because this opportunity presented itself.
Did you feel when you were younger, even just, you know, 12, 13, 14, did you feel like this was something that you were going to do?
From a confidence standpoint, New Zealanders are quite naturally self-deprecating, and we don't really, we don't talk a whole lot about being a star or being the best or something. We are often quick to talk down what we do, which, you know, can be seen as humble and grounded, or it can be negative. But I think in my heart, I knew that I'd really love to do this as a line of work, and I felt like I could make a difference with it, you know, not only to myself but to other people. So I think it was definitely always a sense of a almost spiritual calling that I could really use music as a channel to connect with people. But on the other side, I knew that I should be practical and study something at university. And, you know, I was enrolled to do some study at a university. And so I think that's a classic sort of New Zealand thing where, you know, you dream big, but you're also willing to do the, you know, the responsible thing. And then, you know, I was offered this contract at 17 and I just thought, I have to go for it, you know. So I never got to university and I just went straight into doing this out of high school.
Wow. I think, you know, a lot of people may look at young teens getting, you know, the ones that are famous before they're even 20, and think that that's such a difficult and challenging way to enter into an industry. But it almost sounds like you were doing it for so long before, and you knew you wanted to do it, that it feels maybe a little bit smoother. Or did you find that those few years in the beginning were a little bit like, what the hell am I doing? What's happening?
Yeah, no, I think I am, like, more fortunate that I was able to, like, form a real sense of what I wanted from an early age and what was important to me, you know, what my values were and stuff. And so in those first years of making the album, although it was, of course, you know, challenging at times, and probably more challenging when my career, like, took off really quickly at one point, but I knew from an early age what the reasons were that I made music, and I've always been quite strong-willed about keeping to the integrity of the music and kind of not feeling that I have to change it dramatically to suit a larger market, but rather just, you know, doing what honestly makes me feel excited, because I think that's the most genuine way to get other people excited about your music, you know, is when you, as the artist, feel, you know, moved by what you're doing, and then that's where that sort of solidarity comes in, sharing it with others and saying, hey, join with me in feeling this way about this or that. So, yeah, I think that helps. You know, I wasn't thrown into the Mickey Mouse Club and told what to wear or whatever. I was, you know,
double denim,
strong, stubborn from the word go. And, you know, I guess maybe in the music industry, maybe stubbornness can be a good thing.
Yeah, that's true. But, and also, of course, being, you know, from New Zealand and moving then to Australia, both industries are big, but in comparison to the rest of the world, they're small industries. And obviously there's this almost, you're taunted by this idea of that moving to a bigger country with a bigger reach, you know, will change and elevate your career. And I don't know, I think I'm more interested in the access that artists get when they move, which I feel like you are such a collaborative spirit that I'm sure that moving also helped. But how were the first few years being in the industry then, in your hometown or your, you know, somewhere where you were used to the culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was singing my own songs on guitar. I was, you know, playing snow pops to, you know, people that sometimes listened, sometimes didn't. You know, it was kind of one of those things where I was doing it very much for myself. I was part of a couple of like TV shows when I was young that were just kind of fun, and it was learning about the music industry. I made a few videos, but I was actually less collaborative back then, probably because I was just doing, you know, what I did and kind of just had a lot of fun doing it. But when I moved to a new city, I think I realized, okay, in order to really make use of these opportunities and get that access, like you said, I'm going to have to open up and really, you know, get out of my comfort zone. And it's been a kind of mantra of mine ever since, really. And it's something that you don't do as much perhaps when you're in your hometown, because as you say, you know, there's a certain level of comfort that you have in your own skin and in your own, you know, that you can kind of get by doing what you do on your own. But sometimes being in a new country, I think that, you know, that need to gain insight and sense of community from others becomes a little more desirable, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to try harder. You have to just try really hard to make friends and get out of your usual shell. And by doing so, you land up growing much quicker, at a quicker pace. It may not be for the better. It may not be for the worse. It just is quick. It's such a fast evolution. Yeah. When you were writing songs and you were playing guitar when you were younger, what sort of concerts did you go to? What do you remember at all the first concert that you went to?
Yeah, I was really into a lot of rock music and grunge music, and I think, you know, I mean, I was like every other kid when I was, you know, around 10, 11, 12, I just liked whatever was on the radio, right? Even like Christina Aguilera and Destiny's Child and, you know, all the things that were big at the time. Mm. But I think once I was playing guitar and got closer to like the age of 14 or something, I was really pretty heavily into more alternative and heavy rock. And I think I found a real outlet in heavy music because it was so different to what I was doing, which is this kind of soft, tender singer-songwriter thing.
Yes.
And I think that's the start of me wanting to kind of make tougher music as well. And that's when I started getting into beats, you know, when I, you know, started listening to Nine Inch Nails or Björk or the Mars Volta or something. But my first ever concert was Silverchair,
were
a big Australian band at the time.
And
my dad took me to see them. I would have been about 14, I think. And, you know, I just absolutely loved it. I was moshing in the crowd. It was incredible. And I later went on to make half of my second album with Daniel Jones of Silverchair, so it was a kind of a cool full circle moment.
Did you tell him that you were in the crowd and that was one of your first concerts?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Totally, I did. Yeah,
I love
I
that.
Really stoked, yeah.
Did a lot of artists come to New Zealand, or did you find yourself when you had to go traveling a lot to see the bands that you really wanted to see?
No, I think we were actually lucky that, you know, we had a big festival called Big Day Out where a lot of big bands came. I remember Björk and Rage Against the Machine and Muse and Marsh Alter and, you know, Interpol. Like, a lot of my favorite bands made their way eventually down to New Zealand. So it was always exciting when we got a concert because, you know, we just always felt like we were so far from the rest of the world. And it would be, you know, a real thrill when your favorite band made a stop in Auckland.
Of course. Was there ever any artist that you desperately wanted to see that you finally saw? Like any of your kind of preconceived ideas that were shattered after you saw someone, you know, that you really wanted to see?
I was very lucky to see Aretha Franklin right before she passed away.
Wow.
At the Radio City Music Hall. Yeah, she just did a few songs as part of a documentary screening. And obviously that was special because she later passed, but it was also just like the moment of, wow, you know, whatever expectations I had of that voice, you know, seeing it live was just a whole other, you know, experience. I also remember seeing Jennifer Hudson that same night and being totally blown away by her as a younger artist and just thinking, you know, whatever I'd heard on record was just completely different live, and it gave me so much respect for both of those artists.
Gosh, and especially the timing and the effect that both of them have actually had, you know, on women of color and singers. What about performance really makes you feel? You mentioned the word which I loved earlier. You said it was kind of a spiritual calling for you, which I've always felt listening to your music. It's always so natural to listen to it, no matter what, you know, how many different avenues you go down. What about performance really touches a certain part of you?
Well, I think it's that beautiful synergy between all of those elements, right? You get to step into an outfit that dictates, you know, the way you hold yourself. It's a part of the story. It affects posture and everything. I step into that zone. I do the hair and makeup. I kind of feel that I can now be larger than life, you know. And stepping onto stage and being in a space where I can be fearless and anything goes, you know. It's that sense of, like, in art, it's like God has given us this, like, special place to go to all of our extremes, and there's a safety in doing that, you know. You can be as wild as you want. You can cry with the audience. You can mourn over pain and grief. You can, you know, celebrate things. You can talk about politics even if you want. You can do, it's a free space where you can, you know, kind of deep dive with people. And I think it creates a pathway for transcendence, you know, a moment where someone can watch a show and feel that the artist said something or looked at them in a way or hit a note that vibrationally, you know, shifted something in their body and made them think again about that relationship, or think again about their role in the universe, or think again about, you know. And that's what excites me about live performance, is that I can look in people's eyes and actually feel the sense that what I'm doing could make an actual change in their lives, where they feel a sense of inspiration to deepen their own lives in some way.
I feel sometimes, even if it doesn't affect them in the long term, performance in any capacity, whether it's music or film or art or theatre or dance, there's something about it being so within the moment that you can't ever really get that back. That I really, like, you can't edit much.
That's true,
You know, which I really, like, it's the last, it's our last hope for an unedited experience, you know. And although obviously,
that's right, I think you're exactly right.
I don't know, the person can walk off the stage if you get a song wrong, or, you know, I've watched artists say, like, oh shit, we've got to start that song again, which is fine.
Of course,
but there is something about it being so, even if people are taking their phones out and recording, I never really mind that, because it's still, you're still there, you're still having that sensory experience.
Yep.
Do you remember the first concert that you played?
Oh, that's tricky. I mean, it was a long time ago. I mean, we had a big like high school band competition, and that was probably the first time that I performed on my guitar, one of my own songs. But before that point, I had, you know, as a young kid, I was asked to sing national anthems at rugby games and various things. And I once performed the New Zealand national anthem for an All Blacks game.
Oh, my gosh. I was
pretty young.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. My dad would be, like, going crazy now.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, that's rugby.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. And I think it's just one of those things where you remember those first performances because everything else feels so much easier after that, you know. And so that's an early performance I had of just singing. But I think, you know, probably the first concerts were probably quite ordinary, you know, in the back of a restaurant singing to, like I said, a few people eating dinner or something. And that's, you know, humbling to remember that there's a lot of the most important moments in life are sometimes not these grandiose, huge concerts, but these really simple experiences that alter the course of your life forever.
Absolutely. And actually, a lot of people, I feel quite bad because the nature of this show is really to get people into a place that could be, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, some people 40 years ago that I've spoken to. And a lot of artists by nature are not as nostalgic as you'd expect, because it's quite like art making is quite a forward motioning thing. You know, you're constantly trying to create and move forward. I love that you said how it's quite humbling, because it really is to remember those moments. And I can you imagine somebody in the crowd there, you know, who now can say, oh my gosh, I once remember when I saw Kimbra in a restaurant. you know, it's so amazing.
Exactly.
It's such a cool way to document time. Speaking about those bigger moments that you've had, which obviously you've had really large, incredible milestones. I know that in October you interviewed David Byrne ahead of his tour. Obviously you were joining him in New Zealand. And I know that obviously a few years ago as well, you performed with him for a tribute for David Bowie. And I loved your interview, just reading through it. We had him on the show a few months ago, and I just thought he was just the coolest, most zen human being in the world. You know, he was just so relaxed.
He is an incredible
And we actually named this podcast after one of his Talking Head songs, which is cool. But so I loved what you said in your interview. You asked him what Bowie meant to him. But I'd love to know, what does David mean to you?
Well, we just finished our tour with David Byrne. I also toured around with him through Australia. So it was about 9 to 10 shows or a lot.
Wow.
And we spent a lot of time with him, you know. I mean, I also joined him on stage for a couple of times throughout the tour, singing How You, which is a song by Janelle Monáe that focuses on police brutality and victims who were killed by violence. And, you know, it's a very, very powerful song to perform, and standing right there with David Byrne with my fists pumping in the air. I think, there's many ways David has inspired me. Of course, musically, he's just the most curious soul. He's always pushing and, you know, looking for new ways of expression, and very kind of unselfconscious about that, you know, which I think is something we all admire, is when someone is just kind of not overthinking their process too much and just kind of going more into that dream state of following an intuition. And then on top of that, though, I think what's inspired me more is just him as a person continuing to be so socially aware and using his art to actually speak about things that are important to him. Like, he spent a lot of the show talking about how half the band are immigrants, and he himself is an immigrant from Glasgow. And, you know, he doesn't have to do things like that, but it's a chance for him to, you know, take that step with his fan base and say, hey, there's still things we need to do better. And as a fan of my work, I want you to walk with me in making these changes in the world. And I think that's really inspired me to think of my art as not just entertainment, but also a form of communicating a message to people.
Absolutely. And especially you mentioned that Janelle Monáe song. That is one of my, I've seen this live show that he has, that he's currently touring. And that moment and that song is just, even if people don't know the song, I felt the crowd around me just get up straight away, and people were like tapping their feet and raising their arms. It was very poetic. And how did you feel when he asked you to come on stage for that particular song? Had you heard it before?
Yeah, no, I'd seen them perform it live, and I felt the same way. It was just such an incredible song. But David actually came out of his way, him and his band, to come and see my solo show in Melbourne. I was playing a stripped-down show, which is like the show I'll be bringing to Chicago and all around the state. Yeah, and he, you know, they had a night off, and then the whole band came down to see me play. And I mentioned to the audience that I had, you know, marched in the Black Lives Matter march, and, you know, and talked a bit about my experience in America and witnessing racism there, and just, you know, being, you know, further informed about the Black experience in America. And I think he took that as a cue to perhaps ask me to join him, because he could see that I had a heart for those issues in America. So yeah, it was a really nice way to tie that together, things that are important to me, and also just being a fangirl, excited to be on stage.
Oh no, it's ridiculous. It's just like, and I can imagine he is just as enamored with your work as well, because he is so picky and choosy with who he works with. So I think it's amazing that it's perfect that you got to perform with him. And weirdly, I know that you just mentioned you're going to have a stripped down show, a stripped back show, because that also aligns with the latest album that you released now in October.
Yeah. It's just an EP, and it's only, you know, four songs of Primal Heart, but they're done in a very, very different way. Stripped down, no beats, no crazy production. And yeah, the show will be inspired by that sort of sound palette. And I'll be bringing back songs from Vows and Golden Echo, all three albums, and just kind of like giving them a new home inside the space of acoustics. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a nice way to get really intimate with people and show them a bit more about my songwriting process.
Yeah. Do you feel, though, speaking now, how affected you are by a message of from art, of music? Do you feel that your intention to strip it back and or have collaborators like Dawn Richard and people involved in the reimagining of Primal Heart, was that affected by the cultural climate at all? Or do you feel like you were going to always keep on working on your songs?
I mean, it's an interesting parallel to draw. I think I've always done it, though. If I look back at Vows, you know, I think I never performed Settle Down the same way live. I changed it almost every time we played it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did these sort of same thing, live videos online. I did, you know, change various songs and release an acoustic version of them, and you know, pull on friends to do wild remixes of things. And I think that's always been a way that I try to keep finding inspiration in the songs, is to keep kind of reinventing them. But in terms of stripping them down to their most raw essence, I think that you're right, that that could be a result of wanting to gain a more kind of potent, direct connection with people in light of this very divided world we are living in, and a world that kind of is quick to notice differences on the outside, but slow to realize that ultimately underneath our skin we're all so much very the same, you know, and that's what Primal Heart is all about, is this idea of the human condition and the primitive nature of, you know, every emotion, whether that's fear or desire, and all of these things that drive us have been with us really from day one. And we can find a camaraderie in seeing each other as all going through that, you know. And I think to communicate that kind of message, which is all about extending a hand and saying, hey, let's see what unites us rather than what divides us. In light of that, I think stripping the songs down was actually quite important, you know, rather than doing like slamming dance floor remixes of them.
Yeah, I think it's because I didn't draw that comparison to put it in a box. I just found it really pertinent to what you're speaking about in the music.
Yeah.
You know, you're having obviously questions that relate to the our cultural climate and each other, and it's so honest, and it's needing everyone to be as vulnerable as possible, because I think a lot of it you're asking these questions to yourself, but whilst the question is out there, so the listener lands up asking it too. Well, at least I felt that when I was listening. As an artist, it's not easy to do, to put yourself into a place where you're not necessarily telling people to listen to you and your heart, but you're showing them that there's just another avenue to your life, you know, just a different version, which is difficult, right? It's not something that a lot of artists can achieve. I think it's, I can't imagine, because I think everything I've ever read about you this year is like, Primal Heart is the most honest album to date, and all the, and I've always felt you're a very honest and genuine artist, but I never, I think a lot of people don't think, they're like, yes, the message is honest, but what about your process in getting there? Like, how hard is it to be that vulnerable and then rehash it to a live audience?
Well, I mean, you really have to, you have to have gone through some things, I think, that, that allow you to feel like it's more important to share of yourself than to put up walls to protect yourself. You know, that's that crossroads you come to. It's like, it feels more important to connect with people in the level of suffering and vulnerability than protecting your identity and keeping up a perfect facade, you know, which as women, we do that a lot. I think we feel
we
are under obligation to do that, you know? And I think early days for me were very much about creating a character. And, you know, I love that part of the process. I still create characters around what I do. It's so much fun, you know? It's like a kid playing dress-ups. But when it comes to, like, you know, really sharing from a place where it's very much unique to you and what you've seen, and asking someone to enter into that space, which is to ask them to be vulnerable, I think you need to first set an example, right, which is kind of stepping on stage and being confessional about something, and it grants the audience a kind of permission to go there with you. And yeah, that that was what I did for the 4-song EP. I handed over the production role to Lars Holmsted of Jaga Jazzist, and I really let other people kind of take the helm on the design of the sound, so that I could just step onto that mic and just be the singer. And that was really hard for me, because
I know, you're always looping
but I think that was important.
Totally. Yeah. If you stay the same and do the same things, although you would probably become even better and better, it's that 10,000 hour rule, you know, you're going to become as good as you can get. I think the theme of what you were saying earlier of discomfort and putting yourself in uncomfortable situations, you know, why not just give yourself a little bit of a challenge? I know it's easier said because I'm not the one who did it, but, you know, I think the reward is really seen and heard. And I know that here you've got the Top of the World track. You have that with a new rap verse from Snoop Dogg.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Crazy.
Yeah, Snoop jumped on the track.
Oh my God.
It's incredible. I know.
Did you get to meet him? How did that come about? How did that collaboration work out?
So basically, he really dug the song. It was as simple as that, I think. We had some mutual friends, and somehow the song got to him, and he was really excited by it, and it really just happened from that perspective of him liking it and being down to put a verse on it. We haven't met, you know, during the process. It was done from afar, and I got sent the verse, and I was just losing my mind, you know, because that's one of my favorites. But it's going to be really fun to meet him eventually and just, like, tell him face-to-face how much I loved what he did on the song, because it really gave it a whole new life, really.
And speaking of that, also Version of Me, I know, is a favorite amongst a lot of the fans and a lot of the critics. And it's such a beautiful, it's become now as well in the rework, such a beautiful, brooding, ballad, if I can call it, with Dawn and including her as well. Was that also through friends?
Yeah, that was even more organic, I'd say, where it was like Dawn had been following my music for years and been quite vocal about reaching out and telling me, and I, of course, respected so much of what she did as well. And so we would kind of keep in loose contact just as like fangirls of each other, you know. And then when the record came out, I said to her, hey, if you wanted to reinterpret a song of mine and like do a version of it, a remix of it, I would love that. And then it turned out that she kind of did this almost duet version of the song, and that's what inspired me to say, hey, I think this is really powerful. Why don't we do a photo shoot or a music video around it and take the lyrics to another level and actually bare ourselves and our souls in the song? And I just felt like she was the right artist to ask that, and I swear she said yes in a second. She was on a red-eye flight to New York within days.
Oh my gosh,
pretty incredible.
Yeah, seeing her live as well is an experience. I watched, I think it was not last year or the year before, she was at Pitchfork Festival here in Chicago.
Yeah,
and we were just
I
took thousands of shots of her in the pit. I wasn't meant to.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I'm going to get in, get out, and landed up filling my card because there's so much of her that comes across. She gives you everything.
Absolutely.
Which is just such a gift.
Yes, it does.
So what do you think then? I know that the song is called, I'm just thinking now, but I know the song is called Version of Me, and you obviously, you say next time I'll be kinder with you, but what does the best version of you look like when you're in that way that you feel most creative, most energized, refueled? What does that look like?
I think it looks like a human in a state of flow, right? And I think anyone kind of knows what that means, in the sense that you're able to give from the very depths of who you are, without force, but also without holding back. It's this sort of balance of, you know, natural presence, and also just kind of being so deeply attuned to your gift, you know, and giving that freely. I think it also looks like acceptance for me. You know, the more we fight with ourselves and hate parts of ourselves, the harder it is to actually grow, because the first step in any kind of growth is accepting the conditions or accepting the parts of ourselves that don't feel beautiful and don't feel worthy. So I think, yeah, that the version of me that I aspire to is one of acceptance and then flow outward to others, because I think that is our purpose in life, right, is to be a blessing to others. And that comes first from being able to accept yourself, with all the messy, complicated things that are there, you know? None of us are perfect,
Absolutely, so, I love that.
Something.
Yeah, and also flow is so important, especially as an artist, to feel stagnant in any way, whether that's with your own art or with your relationships. It's not that it doesn't help, because I don't want to put it as a negative thing. I think that it's needed sometimes to get in a rut, so that you can get out of it, you know? But now you're obviously going into this new, I'm not going to say that, as you said, you're going to have songs from Vows and, you know, Primal Heart, you're going to have, but what do you think the upcoming tour, you're at the cusp of it starting. So how do you feel about approaching the new set of songs, whether that's from the reimagined Primal Heart or the album that came out in April as well? What are you feeling as an artist toward that set of songs?
They've really taken on a new life in this context. I think lyrically, people are able to really connect with them in a deeper way. I've done the show, it's in a test run of the show in Australia and New Zealand, and I was sort of blown away by the response. So it's going to be really exciting now to take it to American fans who have only really seen me in very high energy contexts, you know, this performance feels like it's just like, seriously, just chilling and like having a glass of wine with someone and just like having a chat, you know, and that's something I don't do very often, but I'm really excited to translate the songs with as little as possible. Of course, it's a lot more focus on the voice, but I think in this situation, that's really what's most important for connecting with people.
Both internal and the physical, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
But, and I know that obviously speaking about people who inspire you, I know that you did a session or something with Donald Glover. Is that something that you are thinking about releasing, or is it ever anything that will be released? Because that is a duo, Kimbra and Donald. I mean, I don't even know how to not gush about it, you know?
Yeah, it would be amazing if that stuff comes out. I mean, of course, there's still hope that we will get in the studio and finish the things we started. The timing was that he went straight into Atlanta after we worked on things together.
Okay.
And so he kind of, he just kind of had to take a back seat from everything music related at that time. And, you know, gave me the blessing to keep working on songs that we had started, you know, kind of on my own while he worked on what he was doing, you know. But I still have the demos, of course, of things that we did. And there's, you know, there's a song in there, a couple of things that we've done, but like one in particular that's just like such a dope, like heartfelt kind of ballad. And I hope there will be a time when we get to resurrect that. But it's just all about the schedules syncing up and just people actually being in that space to do collaboration, because he's just such a busy guy. So we'll see.
Release the demos. I can hear like the listeners are going to be saying that when they hear you mention that there's a ballad between you and Donald Glover. I can't even, it's giving me chills. I'm excited for hopefully. Yeah, one day.
Well, you know, it's just one day. Exactly.
Yeah. What do you think is the one thing about touring for you that many people might not know about? So something that you do on tour that is maybe unusual, or...
I do watercolors on the tour bus airline lounges and stuff. Yeah, it really relaxes.
Well, thank you for sharing and chatting. I'm so excited for your show in Chicago. I know that it's going to be for all of your shows across. If anybody obviously wants to find out more about your tours, they can go to kimbramusic.com. They can find all your tours. And your show in Chicago is at Talia Hall, so that's going to be also really lovely. Have you played in Chicago before?
A few times, but not in a theater like this. That's going to be very special.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com. Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.